Accession number 17747, reel 50.
I think you were saying that your guns started to go wrong at this stage.
Yes, they must have fired hundreds of thousands of rounds, and I noted that on the 27th of February, a second breech block and ring splits on another of our troop guns. The premature burst opens out the barrel just like a banana skin. With huge force, and very lucky that no one was hurt, a piece of the shell, or the barrel, I'm not sure, the shell probably, hurtled across the field and penetrated a cask of wine to the general satisfaction. And alongside this, you see, it's a very curious no man's land in one's life, because I'd been bemoaning with a friend the night before the fact that we were wasting our lives, young days. We were still only 22, short of 23, wasting our lives doing this sort of thing. And at the same time, we were trying to plan. I mean, I've put think of the administrative civil service as a possible career. This was because all kinds of documentary material was coming out about the end of the war and what would happen, including the recruitment to the civil service through the new method 2, which was the sort of civilian equivalent of WASB, not requiring degree level papers, which we would not be able to take, having just been released from the army, but more general tests of ability. However, that's by the way.
Had you ever thought of perhaps staying in the army?
No, I hadn't. I was asked, but I had not thought of it. And I was quite clear that I didn't want it. I had a slightly more pressing invitation a bit later, I think, after the war finished. But I didn't want it. I had enough of uniforms. 28th of February, Bill Lowes, who was the survey officer in the headquarters, rang me to say that he's going home today. This is after four and a half years in the Middle East and Italy, on compassionate leave, poor chap, because his mother in Monk's Seaton near Durham is going blind and may not see him again unless he goes. A sad tale of the war.
What happened about these guns that were showing signs of
strain? It caused quite a bit of fuss, because I think there was a feeling that we had been mishandling them in some way, and Remy officers, a Remy major, came round and these things were carted away and replaced.
How long did that take? How long did you have to wait before you got a new...
As you speak, my eye lights on the 7th of March. Creamy, that's Remy, that's right, calls to look at the gun that fired the premature. And that was only about a week after it happened, so it was about a week. Presumably we may have had a reserve gun brought in before they came to look at the Duff one. But any guilt attaching to us, I think, was misplaced, because it was only a few days later that one blew up in the neighbouring battery and actually wounded some of the gun crew. They must have been pretty well knackered, these guns.
What, just through having been fired so many times?
Yes, I think so.
I mean, had you been aware that there was an expected life for a gun?
No, we were not aware of this sort of thing. I mean, that was too technical. It's the sort of thing one would read about. We may even have been told about it at Octu, but nobody expected this amount of wear. I mean, these things, I don't know. There must have been a plan in the minds of Remy or HQRA that the guns should be replaced, but this kind of thing was not communicated to us. On the whole, partly because we might have taken fright when we knew that that number of rounds had been exceeded.
Do you think it might have been partly an effect of the difficult climatic conditions and
I suppose it could be. By March, when these things started blowing up, the worst of the winter had gone, so any contraction in the metal would have tended to be modified, unless, of course, they had been weakened by such contraction. Who knows?
Well, extremes of temperature do affect the strength of the metals, don't they?
Indeed. And their operation, as with the clock. Yeah, that's right. It's a very good question you raise. I don't know the answer. I mean, how far the manufacturer of these guns takes into account and tries to compensate for the expansion of metal. Presumably the ammunition expands also, since it's largely metal. But the thought of the Arctic Circle 1 month and the same gun trying to do something in the Sahara Desert the next is a sobering one. There must be a difference in.
Indeed, I mean, the coefficients of expansion of steel and brass are different.
That's right.
Which must affect the fit of the...
Exactly.
..an integrated round into the barrel.
Exactly. And which was the secret of making a perfect timepiece for the Navy in the 18th and 19th centuries, alternating the two, so expansions counteracted each other. But, yes, it's a good question. I wish I knew the answer. I wasn't interested at the time. I mean, when you've got guns blowing up round you, you don't ask particularly what the physics reason might be.
You're just shouting for a new one.
Yes, that's right. And I've got a note here. I don't know, it's not significant, but advance parties arrived from the 17th Field Regiment on the 8th of March. There is a flap on. And we are anticipating battle.
Do you know what they were there for?
I think they must have come up to. They were not replacing us. I think they were coming up to as extra guns. There's all sorts of activity going on at this time.
Well, this is early March.
This is yes, that's right. It's early March. I don't think I mentioned the 17th Field Regiment again. I think they were coming up to play their part and came to visit us as already having been there. It was still slack at this time, although there was an indecently long waiting period during March. The spring was burgeoning and all that. We were doing gun drills, we were doing all kinds of things.
Did you do any serious tactical training?
No, I didn't. It was basic stuff. It was keeping people presumably physically fit and to an extent occupied. I put 19th of March up at an indecent hour for gun drill, get everything ready for the army commander's visit tomorrow. Something big is in the wind. Secret reconnaissance is being carried out. We have a mess meeting and then a message that the general officer commanding's visit is cancelled. We ponder in the mess over the ways of the army. More and more gun drill, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, all gun drill. 23rd, then we hear the rough plan for the next attack, which will not be too pleasant. I haven't said at this stage what it was. 25th of March, prepare a small arms firing range for firing practice with the Scots Guards sergeant and fix 303 details for tomorrow. Hear that the Rhine bridgehead extended 25 miles by 7 in 36 hours, so hopes are high. To a symphony concert. See, this is the alternation of gun drill and preparations for battle with symphony concerts in Peer Gynt, etc., with a characteristically fat prima donna. This is in some theatre in Forli, no doubt. Up the next morning, 7:30 gun drill, 9 to 11 on the command post exercise, then electron guerrilla warfare by a second in command. Into Ravenna in the afternoon, which is some way off, to see camouflaging of gun positions so that we could learn about this for our next operation.
Was there anything new about the camouflage techniques?
I think the thing that was perhaps new was the fact that we were going to be in a more exposed position than we had been used to, as indeed did turn out to be the case.
Do you know why you needed to know about guerrilla warfare? Was there any particular reason for giving you a lecture on that?
I can't think that there could have been, except that we were hearing, and this I'm speaking from memory, not from diaries, that Hitler was determined to go on resisting, and there was the possibility of some very muddled, mixed fighting going on as we got near to the Alps, beyond the Po. There could have been, in theory, endless trouble from a resisting Hitler. Battery commanders' conference. Western Front in Italy is cracking. I've said that bald. I don't know what was happening, except that the Americans were presumably breaking through towards Milan and Turin. Hear that Lloyd George has died, reading Compton Mackenzie. Next day, 27th of March, it seems quite bizarre, a dull day for our regimental sports, just as though we were in Aldershot. I come second in the long jump. I find it unbelievable.
What sort of sports were you doing? Was it primarily athletics?
Yes, it was, yes. Our battery comes last, despite everything, losing even the tug of war. I have a quick walk and go and sit in a church to have a think. And the reason why I come across these entries quite frequently isn't anything to do with, or very little to do with, religious persuasion, because I was already well on the way to agnosticism. But it was I've realised why is the only way of being alone. Reflection was virtually impossible, and having a room to oneself was virtually impossible at any time. There are always other people around.
But it's a collective life.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's like, presumably, although I never went there, it's like being in a boarding public school. And I did need to get away. I didn't like other people's company all the time. Final 28th of March, final gun drill period at 7:45. The Padre is posted off to a paratroop regiment, so we have a farewell cocktail party for him in the mess. Full moon, thunderstorm. 29th March, alone with the troop, presumably Jack Davidson, my colleague, was on leave, getting everything ready to move. Hear that the Western Front in Italy is now really crumbling. Battery commander's vehicle inspection at 1400, then a boring period until we move off at 2200. Broken by dinner at the Albergo Club with the battery commander.
Was this before you moved off? Or?
Yes, before we moved off at 10 o'clock in the 10 o'clock in the evening.
Presume it must have been pitch black by that time.
Except it was full moon.
Ah.
I've put we move off in. It was full moon last night, and we move off at 10 o'clock the following evening. And the 30th was in normal life would have been Good Friday. We had a long drive and see navy boats in a canal, and we cross the canal by a rickety pontoon bridge, and we arrive at a position where we dig ourselves in, sleep from 4 till 8:30, then in daylight we can look round at the dead flat drained land, just like parts, I've put just like parts of Northern Ireland, and we have great emphasis here on camouflage, hence the instruction in Ravenna.
What could you do to camouflage your presence in that sort of landscape?
Well, only obviously dig in to a certain extent, avoid vehicle tracks, use the netting. I don't see what else we could do.
And you were able to dig down without coming to the water table?
To an extent. Indeed, it was quite remarkably dry, this soil, because as I will be saying, a few days ahead, we were actually occupying deep German dugouts, which they had left.
This forward move was an unopposed drive.
Yes, well, what we were doing was at this stage, we were allocated this part of the front, that narrow strip of land to the eastern side of Lake Comacchio.
So effectively you were going up the coast road from Ravenna towards Chioggia and Padua and Venice.
That's right, that's right. Only, the main road skirts, I think from memory, skirts the lake to the west, and we were going up this narrow strip which has a subsidiary road. On holiday last year, we went down that road, and I learnt more about it than I ever knew at the time. It is a huge eel breeding place which attracts eel anglers from all over Italy for a few months in the summer every year. It is the eel centre of Italy. That's right. Yes, I see. No, you're quite right. No, looking at the map, the main road plainly does go up the coast along this strip where we were. Although this, is, of course, a small-scale map, and I think the small print would show some kind of a narrow, very narrow channel, only about a quarter to a half mile wide, going right up between the lake and the sea.
It looks like quite an easy road to defend.
Indeed, yes.
With the lake on the one hand and
the
sea on the other.
I mean, the main attack plainly could not be up there. But you needed somebody going up this. This isthmus or whatever, however I would describe it.
Presumably, if you had been opposed, you could have been supported by naval units on the Adriatic.
Indeed, the navy was there. The lake was crossed, and the attack, the landing on the north was done by, I think, a Royal Marine commander with naval vessels, or Royal Marine vessels. The enemy was at this stage 2,500 yards away across flat land, but we were not engaging. We were sitting in the sun, very tired, and reading. The war news over the radio was getting better and better, and we thought that. And you raised this point some time ago. At this stage, our job seems almost futile. So we really did rather want to survive. 31st of March, slept in the command post, no calls, no radio, no telephones. We have to be silent until the attack goes in, with the commanders doing a subsidiary assault across Lake Comacchio.
Who were your infantry at that stage?
Good question, I don't know.
Presumably they were ahead of you by a kilometre or so.
Yes, yes, that's right. I don't know. I mean, it was our divisional infantry, but whether at this stage we had any... we sometimes had a guards brigade with us. It could have been there. I don't know. It may come out.
You'd had fusiliers at one time, hadn't
you?
Oh,
well, our regulars, of course, were the 8th and 9th Royal Fusiliers and the Queens. They were our troops, and it may very well have been they who were in front of us at this stage. I was taking it so much for granted, whatever it was, that I didn't even mention it. Our attack has to go up a narrow strip of land between the lake and the sea. Read most of the day. 1st of April, uncomfortable night in a bivouac, with beetles, etc., and planes overhead. No Easter spirit here. Just lounge, read, and wait to attack. Reading a book on Parnell. Play chess against Rudolf Horn, who was a significant chess player. Wait up all night in the command post. Cold and damp near the marshes and the sea. Wait for our fire plan to begin and see a boat stuck in the sand. 2nd of April, attack starts 05:30 and goes extremely well.
Were you firing in support of the attack?
Yes, we were firing in support of the attack.
Was it a barrage?
It was pre-arranged targets. I guess it was a lifting barrage.
Did you see anything of the infantry going?
No, we didn't at this stage. No, we didn't see anything of them at all. Mm. We couldn't see the sort of scrub. We couldn't see the Marines on the lake.
Yes.
And the strip was so narrow that the infantry were all debouched up ahead of us.
So you were firing off the map, effectively?
We were firing off. Oh, yes, we were firing off the map. Yes. Mm. Yes, it was prearranged stuff. It was a fire plan, not reactive fire. We were still in the same place the next morning, but we expected to move, and indeed we moved sooner than I expected. We moved at... we had been south of the lakes, the land spit, when we did this firing, supporting the advance up it by the infantry. This becomes clear because on the 3rd of April we moved at 0800 and through chaotic scenes past dead horses onto the Lake Camacchio land spit itself, where we found wonderfully elaborate enemy defensive dugouts, deep, all timbered, as neatly as houses under the sand.
Sand?
Sandy soil.
The horses you saw, were they military horses? Or
German army.
German army horses?
Yes, German army horses. The German army was so heavily served by horses, we found it incredible. We had none. We found these dugouts had obviously been occupied for considerable time and built with great thoroughness. It was intended to be a significant defensive line at the southern end of this spit of land. Heaps of their abandoned kit and loads of tins of sauerkraut, which we didn't touch like. A surprise, in the early evening, three Germans came strolling in through the gun position and gave themselves up to Jack Davidson and me. It's the first prisoners we'd ever taken personally in 18 months.
Was this the first time you'd experienced Germans giving up without having to do so?
Yes, that's right. Well, I wouldn't say that, no. I think there had been... it's the first time we'd seen it happen. I mean, we'd been told about it. When their positions had been overrun, like sensible people, they had given themselves up throughout the campaign. But this was the first time we actually saw three German uniforms walking towards us.
This is active desertion, isn't it, rather than being taken prisoner in action?
I suppose so, but I don't know whether in our army or theirs it would have counted as desertion when you were totally overrun, would it? I don't know. Depends what their orders were.
Yes, did they have their weapons with them?
Indeed they did. We accepted their surrender at revolver point. Ours were unloaded. Jack Davidson, with his commercial acumen, immediately took for himself a loaded Walther pistol from one of them. And for all I know, he took it home. I think he did, eventually.
Do you know what kind of Germans they were? What sort of uniforms were they wearing?
I can't remember. I have no idea at all.
Did they say anything of any interest to you?
No, they just acted as amiably and as with as little show of fear as one might in these circumstances. And we put a bombardier in charge of them and waited for a truck to be brought up to take them back to division. We never saw them again. But after this, of course, everybody began to look for Germans. We found a lot of loot, no more Germans. No trouble from the enemy. There was a big bag of prisoners of war. And you say how many, was it just these three? There were 26 in our gunner regiment, I noted.
Well, who just came and gave themselves up.
Yes, gave themselves up.
Did they come from forward of your gun positions, out of the scrub?
Or having been overtaken by the gun position, well hidden, well camouflaged, they simply emerged. Mm. It was a strange business to see Germans doing this. You said whether technically they were deserters. I don't know, but certainly they were demoralised to the extent of doing this voluntarily, they also wanted to survive. They must have known the game was up.
What was their physical condition, as far as you can
tell? Oh, they looked perfectly ordinary. They were not emaciated or anything. They were filled with all this sauerkraut. Indeed, they'd left full tins of it. These chaps, I guess, must have been in these defensive positions whilst a lot of fighting was going on south of them, and my guess would be that they had seen little fighting.
What age were they? Did you get an impression of that?
No, I can't remember. They were a spread of ages like our people, between 20 and 30. I mean, they were not boys. They were not Hitler's little boys.
Or old men from the
Volkssturm. Or old men. No, they were neither. They were just your average run of soldiery.
And you mentioned that you found lots of loot. What sort of loot?
I can't remember. I mentioned food, there was plenty of that. Bits of German uniforms, helmets, a ragbag of stuff, the kind of kit that would be left behind if you decided to decamp. Kit bags, that sort of thing.
Had they actually sent any fire back in your direction during the attack?
No, we had had a night without shells landing on us, except there may have been a sporadic one, but there was no real attack.
So they did no counter-battery?
No. There's no record of us being attacked during that battle at all. I mean, they were obviously demoralised and getting back as fast as they could. Given the narrowness of this spit of land and the knowledge they must have had that the commandos were on the lake, I think they beetled back like hell. So it turned out to be, in fact, an easy battle. You asked what the infantry were. Our fire plan was in aid of the Guards Brigade on the spit. So it was the Guards. Cold and dull, 6th of April. Field Marshal Alexander is in the vicinity, but his proposed visit to us doesn't materialise. We hear one round of gunfire. One gun seems to have gone off almost by accident. Just one. It was nothing. It was distant. It wasn't one of our guns. Things are peaceful again, and I start writing up my big log, my own personal accounts and an account of anything which I might contribute to the regimental diary. I got into the habit, you see, of doing this in all that time in RHQ.
Couldn't break yourself of
that's
the,
right. That's right. And this was being done rather bizarrely on the top bunk in a German dugout.
How deep was the German dugout?
I would think about 8 feet. I mean, it was the room for double bunks, you see, all round. I mean, they were really comfortable.
How much overhead cover did they have?
I should have thought of at least 3 feet of earth and all the timbering, of course. I mean, it wouldn't have been proof against a direct hit.
But it would keep out splinters.
That's right.
But did you have a chance to look at their fighting positions? Because these sound like accommodation positions, really.
No, the answer is no. We were not interested. Irresponsible. We tended not to be students of war. We were not really tremendously interested in the theory of it. We were interested in having to get on with immediate preoccupations. Perhaps this is the difference between amateurs and regulars. Had we been regulars, we might have brought a Sandhurst eye to it, but we didn't. Um, Ah, you to ask what sort of stuff they had left behind. 7th of April, we're throwing to each other German ammunition bags, like cricket balls, just as we would cricket balls. Message of good wishes from General Sir Richard McCreary, General Alexander, and Mark Clark on the eve of what is said to be a grand final attack. These messages put me in mind of Shakespeare's Henry V. Command post is cosy but too noisy to work in peace and feel a bit fed up. Go off on Sunday, the